Those things occur to me. I mean, about the question of the wall, the Great Wall of China didn't work to keep out the Mongols. Hadrian's Wall didn't work. The Berlin Wall didn't work. So they're building another wall, they're trying it yet again, and pouring enormous resources into the construction of this wall to wall themselves in. However, I do have another question, which is kind of a question that people speak about very quietly within the Jewish community, which has to do with the settlers and the settlements, which I see as a major, major difficulty, a major wall, if you will. And my question is, who are the settlers?
My grandfather used what I only belatedly learned was a Yiddish word, and not his pronunciation of an English word, fanatik. But that's the short answer. I also know, as a Jew from New York, I know that a lot of them are immigrants from the United States, from Brooklyn, who Brooklyn is now. Although many people still associated with Jews. Okay, so you know. Brooklyn is, used to have be full of people like you. It is now an extraordinarily multicultural place. A lot of the Jews who didn't want to live in that conflicted, contentious, multicultural society moved to, not only to Israel, but to the settlements. But that's not all who they are. So people who've been there who are better informed than I.
Well, the settlements, as we do know, they are populated by Western, often North American, Orthodox religious young people, young families coming in. And the thing is that those settlements are a very good deal. They're very cheap. They're great mortgage payments, very cheap. The Israeli government uses the settlements in order to take over Palestinian land, very basically. Now, the wall is another step, but first became with the settlements. They'd have basically eaten a great amount of Palestinian land, with the fact also that the roads, that are built in that area. Now we have such an incredible situation where we have Jewish roads and we have Palestinian roads.
Yeah.
I mean, it's disgusting when you think
Israeli
about
roads.
No, but I mean, I call them as Jew because Israel is what? Israel is a Jewish state or it's not a Jewish state? So Israel has got Jewish roads. I use it to be,
Israeli
but I'm being a little bit provocative when I say that. But I mean, it's coming to what? Israeli roads. So. We have one population allowed on one kind of road and another population allowed on another kind of road, and that particular, the Palestinians, as it well pointed out, hardly have those roads, and they're certainly well impeded into using them in any way. The settlements, therefore, they're a very good tactic for the successive governments of Israel, whether so-called left or right, because they usually arrive to becoming the same thing, certainly when it comes to settlements. It's a card that they play back and forth. It's also a card for attracting, thank you, American monies to the state of Israel. And I'll let other people continue.
I think that was a pretty good answer. I think that there are two kinds of settlers, and they're the settlers that Fabian was specifically talking about, who are there. Well, there are settlers that are there for ideological reasons or religious reasons, and they're the ones who truly believe in the idea of a greater state of Israel, that the biblical parameters of Israel are the goal and the intent, and And then there are settlers who are also there for economic reasons. A lot of Eastern European, you may have said that. There are a lot of Eastern European people that have...
in the settlements.
In some of the settlements. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot...
arguing about this.
A lot of Eastern European immigrants that came to Israel and had very little took advantage of the fantastic benefits that were offered to live in the settlements. There are also a lot of settlers that have been that have either moved out of the settlements or have shown an interest in moving out of them. A recent poll said that 80% of settlers, I think, mm-hmm. would. If given any sort of economic incentive, meaning basically to have the same lifestyle that they have there, or even, presumably somewhat less without the risk in Israel proper, would actually make that move. I think it's really important what Fabian was saying about the settlements being very much a tool. You know, there's this idea that somehow the Israeli government and the settlers are at war with each other, and it's not to say that there are settlers who do refuse Israeli government policy, but they were put there, and Israeli policy has created a very specific spaces for those settlements to be. It's been to take over the aquifers, the major water resources in Israel. So now you have settlement blocks that Israel says, well, now it's populated by Jews, so what are we going to do? Like it's part of our country now. Which happen to just rest over top of the major water resources, which are a huge deal in the Middle East. So things like that. I guess one other thing that I wanted to say is that the settlers are armed and very dangerous, and do things like engage in land expropriation on a really regular basis. Are known for stealing harvests, for just taking over land, just grabbing it and.
Terrorizing
the population. I mean, there are stories of things that can only be called pogroms that have been carried out by settlers within Palestinian towns and villages, where people have been shot and people have been killed when settlers have come in fully armed and just sort of gunning for whatever. I think that's really important. And anybody who spends any time around the settlers also knows that they are fully protected by the Israeli military. So I know that the ISM was involved in a campaign called the Olive Harvest Campaign, which whereby internationals were helping Palestinians to harvest their olives. Now, they weren't protecting them from Israeli soldiers. They were there to help to protect them from Israeli settlers, but the soldiers were there to protect the settlers and to defend the violence that they did. So.
Well, the first thing I would say is God bless you. I don't know if you blessed me if you knew my politics, but I think that, if it's very ironic that people like you, people like me, are demonized by mainstream Jewish institutions, because at the end, looking back, if there's some kind of Nuremberg further down the line or something like that, I think it's people like us who will... as far as anything like Jewish honor, if there's anything to speak about that, it's being spoken here. I would like to ask you what you think of this theory, because, the biggest casualty of Zionism, what's happened, is the crown jewels of Judaism, which be the Yiddish cup. And I think people's heads are so bent out of shape, filled up with misinformation, just complete mythology, the word was used, that really the direct way has to be just getting certain facts established about the history of Zionism in Israel. For example, some people say, when you talk about the occupation, they'll say, well, look, the occupation started 100 years ago. I have this idea that's shaping in my mind that the reaction of Jewish people worldwide to the facts that slowly breaking through about Israel, and think what they know about anyway, it's like this classic reaction to a trauma. There are these stages of denial and bargaining and all of that. I think maybe that's the best way to see it as far as getting something done. But anyway, thank you very much.
I got your question right. Are you asking if it's just getting facts out that is necessary?
If you think that this process is similar to that.
You know, it's funny because for many years I no longer said anything about all of this. I got to the point where I felt that there was no place to say it, there was not much point. It's since the occupation and the Second Intifada that I realized I couldn't not say anything, even if I, you know, I'll try. And you know what? I don't think it's a question of just facts. On the contrary, we've been battling facts back and forth for 25 odd years or more. And in order to hear each other, and I hope I'm answering your question properly, in order to hear each other, it seems we have to go somewhere else. It's not just issues and facts and your house and my house and 3 meters and 4 meters and your father and my father and his grandfather. It can't be that anymore. Because as someone who yelled at me at one point in another talk about Zionism, he's going on, 300 years ago, I said, well, please, I don't want to talk about the history of Zionism today. I want to talk about what Zionism is doing now. What it did, we can read about it. We can talk about it at another time. But what is it doing now? And I think this is ways of coming through some of the difficulties we have in speaking about these issues, is not to deal, we don't have to go to war. We have to speak, we have to create dialogue. And as far as, I don't know what your politics are, should I ask you and get a very long explanation? Or But no, you mentioned it. So the thing is that I think that when it comes to my politics, anyways, what I've learned over the years is that I have to try and figure out how to address not what they're saying to me, but what's behind what they're saying. What's bothering them? And why they're hiding. I want to ask them about, to address why, the reason why they are hiding behind those walls. And that seems to maybe have a little more hope with it.
I'm very much interested in what you say about this notion of post-traumatic stress, because you could say that of humanity since Hiroshima, you could say that of humanity since the Holocaust, you could say that of the Jews, certainly, since the Holocaust. But where do we go? What do we do? We're all scarred. We're the people who have to do it. We can't take the analysis of post-traumatic stress and use it as a reason for not acting. It makes it harder. And to reduce everything also to a psychological condition, not to realize that there are international power situations going on, that the United States, which maybe has its own post-traumatic stress, I say this as an American, but you know, is a player in this. Well, how did they get to be, you know, et cetera. There are other kinds of interests involved in what goes on in the Middle East, and you know, we merely have to deal with saving the Jewish soul.
Really?
Okay,
is
sure.
Is that the object? To only be? Are you saying that sarcastically?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a, you know, it's ghetto irony. You know.
Okay. Thank you.
Just like a really quick response is, I heard Iri Avneri say something that actually has meant a lot to me, which was that, that we'd all like to think that suffering breeds an understanding of suffering and breeds empathy. That's a beautiful idea. And I think I used to believe in that. and that the reality is that is the opposite, that suffering can breed selfishness. I mean, we think to the ill person, to the person who's physically suffering, and we think about the fact that we have to think about the fact that they will think about their illness and they will think about their pain, as opposed to being able to think about the other and be able to empathize with the other. And I mean, it's complicated because to say suffering is a, you know, once we're talking about two generations later, a generation later, or two generations later, you know, I didn't suffer. I lived in peace and comfort and middle class life in Winnipeg, you know, with total integration, with no fears of, you know, of racist violence towards me, with no sense that on any level, you know, I was going to be persecuted or held back from doing whatever I wanted to do because I was Jewish. So I mean, I don't have an answer at all. I think there's some really interesting and important things to think about, though.
Could I just add one?
I do want to open it up more, but go ahead.
Just one small thing that I found absolutely fascinating when I was getting Jewish women together with Palestinian women, and which was very, very hard for them to even try to get into the same room that many years ago. And often it would be the Palestinian women who would say, all right, we're going to do it. We're going there, okay? And I mean, we're talking grandmothers, we're talking different age groups, but usually older women, and they would be giving hell to the other women saying, we've got to go, okay? We've got to talk. Then it would come to the Jewish women, and the most interesting thing I found was that these Jewish women didn't have to be grandmothers that were there in 48. These Jewish women would be women from European, for instance, in France, middle class, from whatever, or here, the same thing. And their whole issue with this was, my historical pain, I have the right to historical pain, which I had a very, very difficult time with. How come we have the right to historical pain? And their pain is not existing, it's not historical. So it was a question of the way we mythologized within our own community and mystified the question of a superiority or a right to pain.
Okay. Yeah, then Janet, then you.
Oh, well, thank you. I was wondering about, as you interact with people outside of, like, the Jewish community, with solidarity activists that are working for, you know, justice for the Palestinian people, have you, in your experience, detected any kinds of anti-Semitism within the movement? And has there been pressure on you to kind of bite your tongue? In other words, there can be the opposite pressure. You can feel the pressure of not speaking out, you know, in your own community, but also there might be that opposite kind of pressure within what we'll call the progressive community, that sometimes maybe these things would happen, but it may be also as equally difficult to speak out when you may or may not hear things that are anti-Semitic. And I also would like to ask you, in a second part, is from the perspective of the ladies that are speaking here, is what is your reaction to the whole discourse of the so-called new anti-Semitism that is sweeping throughout Europe and this whole discussion about this? I know this is a big topic, but I mean, if you could give me a one-liner for my tape here, it'd be great.
To answer your first question, I personally didn't, among the activists in the ISM, didn't meet any anti-Semites, but I heard, you know, that there were, you know, one or two, you know, making comments that were not acceptable, and I thought most of the people were very opposed to that. And as far as the second question about anti-Semitism in Europe.
This new anti-Semitism,
yeah.
where it is now that Israel is being singled out for special scrutiny, and this is a form of anti-Semitism because other states also are equally guilty of many human rights violations. Why aren't they being singled out, and why is Israel being singled out? And this is a blatant example of anti-Semitism, once again singling Jews out for special scrutiny.
I don't agree with that. That it's special. I think you can always criticize the policies of a state, and I think something similar is happening in the U.S. They say there was a lot of sympathy after the 9/11, but when they started being aggressive and flouting international norms of behavior and so on. People think now that there's a lot of anti-Americanism, but it's not against the people, it's against the policy of the government. And I think the Israelis have done the same thing, to their country. I'm sure there are always some anti-Semites who lurk about and look for an excuse or an opening to badmouth Jewish people, but I think a lot of the criticism of Israel is perfectly valid and not in the least anti-Semitic.
Zionists have told us for decades that Israel is the voice of the Jewish people, that the Israeli government, not Israel with its dissidents and its draft refusers and its courageous struggles against the wall, but that Israel, the state of Israel, the government, the whatever government it's got at the moment, is the voice of the Jewish people. It is what it means to be Jewish. And then when Israel commits crimes against humanity, it isn't, why should we be surprised that then they say, that's the voice of the Jewish people, so the Jews are doing this. If that means that Israel is making the rest of us unsafe in and outside of Israel, then that has to be thought about. It's not just that people are complaining about the so-called new anti-Semitism, that Israel is being held to a higher standard, although we've seen this in the last few days with the trial against the wall, particularly that's opening in The Hague, but that Jewish institutions have been attacked, and occasionally Jewish individuals, schools, and so forth. But it does have something to do with the fact that if we are constantly being told to be anti-Israeli is to be anti-Semitic, so somebody who's anti-Israeli says, look, so that's right, I'm anti-Semitic. It is very important for all of us to understand what the difference is, and for Jews in particular to understand that the range of opinion and discussion, all the Jewish jokes about, you've got a dozen Jews, you've got two dozen opinions about, that's the shul I wouldn't set foot in, all of that doesn't stop at the borders of Israeli policy. It cannot be allowed to stop there, and in Israel, of course, it doesn't. There are not only is Israeli dissidents, there is a range of Israeli dissidents. There is the incredibly courageous refusal on the part of young people to serve in that military, but there is also the refusal on the part of people who have served in that military, who were elite officers, pilots, who at a certain point have said what the resistors and the resistor organization said, this still goes on, said at the time of the invasion of Lebanon, Yesh Gvul. It's a pun apparently in Hebrew. It means that there is a limit, but it also means there's a border, which is not being respected. There were two American magazines in recent months had cover stories on this issue that you're raising, Yaya. One of them was the New York magazine, which had a thing on the new anti-Semitism, and the other was the Nation magazine, which had a large review called The Myth of the New Anti-Semitism. And the question is whether it is new, or whether it's the old anti-Semitism revived, or if it's something else that is not happening.
I'm going to talk, I will address your question about the Palestinians. I had a little bit different experience than both Helga and Shira. I spent many, many years with the Palestinians from the inside. And there is one constraint. When you're outside of the Jewish community, you don't want to hang out dirty Jewish laundry. When you're outside of the Palestinian community, and I have been such an integrated part of that Palestinian community, you don't want to wash dirty Palestinian laundry outside either. Okay, there is a very, very you walk on eggs with all of this. In my case, after many years of work, I ended up marrying a Palestinian. You always marry one of these, right? I married a Palestinian who had a Jewish mother, which was quite astonishing. I did not know that when I married him. I didn't marry him because he had a Jewish mother. We would actually have fights for this because he was born in the Syrian camps. His mother, a young woman, anyway, very very young woman, across her street in Tiberias. Tiberias. And married the Muslim that she fell in love with. And of course was repudiated from her family and was taken in 48 along with all the other people in that particular city to the camps in Syria where they were born. Now I only relate that because when you get involved in all these issues and you've been dealing with all this, when you marry someone from that particular group, you have a different entry into Palestinian society. He was also politically involved, therefore that is another kettle of fish as well. I'm going to say something though, and that is that there is no way that there is no racism against Jews or Israelis within the Palestinian community. Of course there is. And by the way, there are many... Sorry?
And why shouldn't there be?
Exactly. And there are many different Palestinian communities. It's just like the whole thing of the Jewish people. We are not one people. We are many different peoples. Well, the Palestinians, the same thing. The ones in Lebanon, where they come from in Lebanon, means different things. Whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Jordan, whether it's in the West Bank, whether it's in Nablus or in a refugee camp is different. Where Gaza, in Iraq, wherever, they are all different elements that have made them Palestinians of different, different Palestinians, like it makes Jews different as well. And for me, the most one of the things that made me become such a impassioned person about all of this was precisely Palestinian reaction to Jews and racist reaction to Jews. And it was racist reaction to Jews by young children, by terrified young children in my home that could not sleep in my home when they had been brought to my home because they thought I was going to kill them. A little girl of 9 years old screaming in front of me, get me out of this house, because her family had been killed in a bombing. And she hated me. I was personified evil. That's it. There's no three ways around this stuff. Okay? Her brother, who was 17, I think he had what we would usually call in English, what do you call this kind of rite passage? It was his rite of passage was to talk to a Jew. And that's exactly how he put it. Muhammad was terrified of me. He was doing this across the table. Okay, that's racism. That's hatred. But it was totally justified. I knew it was. And that boy put himself, what I knew was the biggest ordeal in his life, was to say, I want to talk to a Jewish, this woman, let me know, okay, what is she like? What is this about? By the end of that conversation, that young man passed me his keffiyeh, put it around me and said, I want you to know wherever you are my Palestinian Jewish sister. That was a lot. That was many years ago. And yes, so I'll let that go for you.
Well, I don't have this dramatic story as that. But yeah, no. There are children that I met in refugee camps who had never met a Jew before, who wasn't a settler or a soldier, you know, who had never met a Jew who didn't want to shoot them or their parents or, you know, didn't want to put their father in detention or, you know, or something like that. And in the Nor Sham refugee camp outside of Talkaram, there were kids who, there was one kid who wouldn't come out when they found out that I was Jewish, wouldn't come out from behind his mother's skirt, and she had to like coax him out slowly. But I mean, God, it was understandable that he would have that sort of fear. Just on another level, just in relation to anti-Semitism in a more broad sort of way, I've heard things that I consider to be anti-Semitic, not overtly, but that relate to ideas of a sort of Jewish conspiracy that somehow dictates and controls media, you know, international finances, and the United States government. And it hasn't happened a lot that I've actually heard things like that, but I know that those ideas are out there for sure, and I think that they're growing. Two responses to that are that one, I think it's that's one of the reasons that I actually think it's incredibly important for Jews to be involved in the solidarity struggle with Palestinians, because having a presence is the only way to mitigate that, and to not allow Jewish institutions, which insist that to be Jewish is to be supportive of Israeli policy, you know, to sort of like be the standard way of understanding Jewishness. And the other thing is that something that's started to become clear to me is that there is an internalization of that, I think, among sort of mainstream Jewish community, in that there's this sense that somehow, how could I put this, that somehow we control American policy. Let me try and find a way to explain that. That Israel will always be supported by the United States, no matter what it does. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, to me anyways, that the reason that the United States continues to support Israel and send it such huge amounts of financial support is because it plays a role in its domination of the Middle East. And if Israel were to become enough of a thorn in its side and were ceased to serve some of its purposes, that would cease to be true. But I think that I hear ideas on a regular basis coming from the mainstream Jewish community that assume that somehow we do have America in our back pocket. And I think that's scary.
You'll be a pain in the ass there. One thing. Janet.
Yeah. I was waiting for somebody to say something provocative this evening. I haven't heard it as yet, and I'm ready to forego my place for someone who really wants to raise something provocative. Otherwise,
there's
I shall continue.
Behind you who does.
It's
all right.
Not at all provocative. Can I still ask?
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to know a little bit more about the ISM and how you guys were treated. I'm assuming you spent time in Israel, but like in Israel when you were. So how you were treated by the Israelis and how the going back and forth was. And also if you did any work that wasn't more just pacifistic protesting or whatever, like if you actually, I don't know, helped, like, build stuff, helped in the communities.
I was only there for 3 weeks. First 2 days, we met up in a place in Jerusalem, and then we went to Ramallah for 2 days of training on what to expect from the soldiers, how to minimize any conflict if it should arise. It was important, it was emphasized how important it was not to escalate anything because the Palestinians were the ones who would suffer. So hotheads were not welcome. What kind of activities? The only thing I participated in was one roadblock removal where people gathered around and dug up those huge concrete boulders that were blocking that path, blocking the cars from going through because they were going to cross one of those settler-only roads. So for 200 settlers or so, they inconvenienced 20,000 Palestinians. And the other things were the demonstrations against the fence. And, you know, we didn't do anything. Well, unless you could call it violence, shaking the fence. And I think at one demonstration, some people used wire cutters to. But considering the demolitions and destructions on the other side, I thought this was kind of minimal. And it was a fence on their own land, after all, and one that was keeping them from earning a living. So that's the only experience I had that they did.
I didn't get to spend any time really in Israel this time around, so I can't really respond to that. Actually, I would love to know more about how Israelis respond to people in the ISM and internationals in general that are spending time in the West Bank and in Gaza. I know that there have been, there's been information and misinformation about the ISM going around Israel. And I know that there were demonstrations, small demonstrations, when Rachel Corrie was killed, and I believe also when Tom Herndl was killed. So to support them, or to support their families. What did I do? Mostly pretty straight, pacifistic things. Mostly rode with ambulances to help them get through checkpoints, which may or may not have worked. It's hard to tell. And stayed in the house, actually, of a house that was supposed to be demolished. We stayed there for just a few days, though. And helped to take down a couple of roadblocks. So much of what you do is so symbolic, and I think that's something that you figure out really quickly when you're there with the ISM, that, you know, we were there for a couple of days in one of the 30 houses that was up for demolition in that region. And, you know, we were there for a couple of days. So, you know, like, it's probably been destroyed at this point. And you know, the roadblocks have probably gone back up again. And so it's just, you know, it's such a symbolic thing that you're involved in so much. I think that's why there's such a focus on protest and on demonstration, because, quite frankly, there just aren't enough internationals that are there to be present at, you know, at every single, home demolition or every every checkpoint or whatever. So, I mean, having a presence is important, but so much of what we do is